Welcome to the Nation Magazine Podcasts. You're listening to Nation Conversations, exclusive audio of Nation forums, events, seminars, and salons.
My journey is, has been an arduous one. I was a lobbyist, obviously, for just under 10 years. I am a conservative. I came up through the Republican Party together with Ralph Reed, Grover Norquist, to some degree Karl Rove. I haven't talked to any of them since the trouble. Sometimes politicians are not as with you when you're in trouble as when they need you. But I basically was an aggressive lobbyist on behalf of my clients. And started going over lines. And even though the lines in the sand are, frankly, murkily drawn, and there's really no reason to go over lines, you can be entirely inappropriate and despicable within the lines. But unfortunately for me, I decided to even burst beyond those borders somewhat consciously, and mostly just because in the system and the way I operated, I stopped caring where the lines were. I wanted to attain victory on the causes I worked on and the clients I worked for, really at virtually any cost. And that was a problem. It was a personality problem, and it was a, I say it's 100% me, and it's 100% the system. It's 100% me that there are people in the system who don't act like that. And it's 100% the system because the system is set up in a way that enables and facilitates people who do act like that, and I know it's not a newsflash for all of you, but I'm not the only one who is doing that stuff, and they're doing it even as we sit in here today. They're doing it. So I pled guilty to, as relates to this, three counts. Actually, as relates to the specific area of lobbying, one count, which was specifically overindulging public servants in gratuities in an effort to ingratiate myself and my team of people who worked for me. I had about 40 lobbyists who worked for me at the peak, and as a way to influence their policy decisions. And while I was doing that and was involved in that, not only did it seem natural and okay, it didn't seem like there really was any other way to do it. I think that many people who are in the system probably suffer from the disease I suffered from, which is not to trivialize, of course, how the phrase "the banality of evil" came about. Of course, in much more horrific circumstances, but it became, in essence, a commonplace scenario to do these things. I wrote in my book that I would be shocked when my lobbyists would come back from a senatorial office having solicited from them favor and not be asked for money. I said, did you forget, or did you, did this slip your mind, or maybe you left early? What happened? That literally was the world I operated in. Well, probably for the best for me, that came crashing down. Started with a Washington Post article, but the initial Washington Post article was no different, really, than encomiums that were in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal on the front pages, basically talking about how much we charged, and to a lobbyist that becomes an advertisement. My good friend Senator McCain took up the cudgels of this and wound up driving it a little further. And what at first to me, living in kind of a fantasy land, thinking that, well, this will blow over, everything blows over in America, Americans are ADD, and so anything that they see, they'll forget about 2 weeks later, didn't blow over. And that sort of transitioned me to the phase of, well, why are they picking on me? What am I really doing? All right, maybe I did more of it than everybody else, but am I really doing something different than everybody else? And is this wrong? And, that kind of denial. And then I started the process of examining the 850,000 emails I wrote during the time I was a lobbyist, which was just under a decade, I guess I had diarrhea of the fingers or something, but I just didn't. And I eventually, by the way, became the poster child for don't put in an email, that which you don't want to read on the front page of the Washington Post. I read many of my emails on the front page of the Washington Post, much to my great chagrin. But and as I started to, honestly, I decided to take an honest look at myself and an honest look at what I was doing, which a lot of people don't do. I was in prison for many, many months with people who didn't do that still. It was the old Shawshank Redemption line that I'm the only guilty person in the prison. I wasn't the only guilty person in the prison, but at least I had come to terms with it by reviewing my emails and, you know, looking at things that I'd written years before and thinking, what in the world was I thinking? What was I doing? How could I have divorced myself so far from what I had hoped to be, and turned out to be. So I didn't fight. I didn't even talk, really. I gave an interview to Mother Jones. Nobody from the Nation approached me. But a very a fine reporter from Mother Jones, which, by the way, but also just as unlikely it is that I'm sitting here in front of the Nation, that I would choose Mother Jones as a place. I gave an interview to Vanity Fair as well, but I didn't really speak about these things because quickly it became obvious in the American justice system, when they're starting on you, that you're done. And I came to learn over the years, of course, that 97% of the people they go for are in prison, one form or another. So I got that pretty early, and I realized I wouldn't be the most attractive defendant even if I went to court. But I was guilty. I'd done things that were wrong. I hadn't necessarily done all the things I was accused of doing. I mean, I was accused of actually, in one of the New Orleans papers during the height of all this, I was accused of being responsible for Hurricane Katrina. Now, I was a good lobbyist, but I was in no way that good a lobbyist. And, but I sat quiet and I went to prison. When I entered prison, I didn't know how long I'd be in prison, which is very unnerving. And 22 months into my prison sentence, I got sentenced for these DC crimes. And I wound up there a total of 43 months. Now, hopefully nobody in this room has been to prison. You don't want to be in prison today. Now, I wasn't in maximum security prison, but the people in the minimum security prison, 90% of them come from maximum security. It's just not a pleasant place to be. And even if it's the Ritz-Carlton, you don't want to be in prison. You know, the human condition is such we don't want to be constrained and confined. So it was torturous in that respect. But there, I had an opportunity to further start thinking about who I was, what I had done. And by the way, I didn't go to prison for a couple of years after I pled, and I started this process before that. This all started in February of 2004. And I started to probably realize that I wasn't who I thought I was 6 months into it. So every day since then, including today, is a process for me of examination, of figuring out, you know, where I am, what I'm doing, what is the reason for me to be here. So I decided when I was in prison, you know, the truth is, after having been on the front page of the Washington Post more than John Kerry was when he was running for president, while he was running for president, which I found to be bizarre, and having news crews camped outside your house and walking into restaurants and the entirety of the patronage sneering at you and everything else, frankly, I kind of thought, well, I just want to go hide in a hole somewhere and just go out and earn a living, and I have to give a lot of what I make to restitution, that's fine, but just eke a living out, try to heal my family, my children, and try to get through this and just have another life. But in prison, I thought, you know, I know things. I've been to places that I wish I had never been, but I've been there. And I was involved in things that a lot of people, most people, haven't been involved in, thank God. And I probably have some knowledge that could be useful to folks, and that the system that I exploited needs to be changed. The system ultimately is not a moral system, and it's not a system that, whether one's on the right or the left, one can, or in the middle, one can look at and say, this is good for our country, this is benefiting our country. And so I started, in prison they'll have a track that you can walk around. They don't have a lot of equipment. They took all the weights out of prison and stuff like that, but federal prison. But they had a track, a kind of uneven, gravelly path, and I would walk around the track thinking to myself. And I started thinking, every effort that is made to reform the system, the Washington system, is a joke. And why is it a joke? Because the people who are in charge of reforming this system are the ones benefiting from this system. And they're the folks who want to one day be the lobbyists. And the lobbyists, their attitude is, whatever you pass won't be sufficient because we'll get around it. And that's, by the way, what my attitude was. And even more invidious and more chicanerous, perhaps, the attitude we had when we saw reform bills coming was, great, here comes what we would call a moving train, something that was going to be proposed, passed, get through conference, and get signed by the president. Because everybody passes reform bills. Those are popular bills. Unlike, appropriations bills sometimes have trouble and other bills like that. So we as lobbyists would wait for reform bills and then try to throw onto that moving train as much garbage as we could and hope that it stays. And so I myself did that, and I write about it in my book. You draft the most obscure language you could for a provision you were trying to get at. Now, there was a bill called the Help America Vote Act. I don't know if you all remember that. But that bill was to write, at least in theory, the hanging Chad issue, if you remember from the 2000 election. And that bill was the main sponsor, I guess, and the one whose committee it was in was Congressman Bob Ney, who from Ohio, who was in the House Administration Committee, I think, or something like that. And that bill, that was its purpose. Well, I almost successfully stuck onto that bill language that I still haven't memorized. It's in the book somewhere. Public Law 136.2, Section 3, Subsection 2 is deleted. That was it. All right. And that would have made legal a casino in Texas for one of my Indian tribal clients. Now, I knew nobody was going to read that bill except Bob and his staffer. Well, Bob wasn't going to read it, but his staffer might look at it. And I knew that if somebody did somehow decide that they were a good government type and they wanted to read the bill, there's no way in the world they'd figure out what that meant. And let's say they were genius. They still have to go get the U.S. Code and pile through to find exactly where this is. And, nobody was going to do that correctly, by the way. Nobody did do it. And but for the fact that a certain senator didn't stay bribed, all right, and turned at the last minute, that would have become law. And so I decided when I was in prison, those reform bills are jokes. What if there was really a reform bill? What would I, as a lobbyist, have gone to war to stop if they tried it? And I sort of calculated in my mind what were the worst things that I could do if I were a reform person, and if I were a lobbyist, I'd have to try to stop them. And I wrote them in my book. And I tried, and in my book are proscriptions that are not those that would be shared by the right and by the left. However, a few of them are. And so what I've tried to do since my book has come out is to meet with all the very groups who were spending their time smashing my face in, rightfully so, while I was a lobbyist and while I was in the midst of the scandal and even as I entered prison. And I reached out to them, including those who were presently attacking me, saying that, why don't I name more names? Why don't I help them put more people in jail? Well, if you've been in prison, you don't want to put anybody in prison, I'm sorry to say. And so I can't engage in that. I can't cause somebody else the kind of suffering that we've had. Whether they deserve it or not, that's for somebody else to do. So those groups I've tried to say, look, that's just not what I'm doing. What I'm trying to do is work on things that I think would damage the system and change it that the right could accept, because right now the right doesn't speak on this issue. The right's just totally silent. Even though, I've been on about 300 talk shows, radio shows, and a bunch of TV. Now, TV, it's really Fox, is really the right-wing channel. But the talk radio, most of the talk radio world is right-wing. And I have yet to have any host or call-in person on the right challenge anything I'm saying. And what I'm saying is, to my knowledge, the things I'm hoping for are, for the most part, entirely acceptable to the groups that I'm working with who are on the left. And what I've been trying to do is say, look, we're not going to get anything through. Nothing's going to happen in this country unless the right and the left can agree on it. It's just not going to happen. The country's too evenly divided. This in particular, all the insiders are going to try to stop because it affects their lives very seriously, or their plans dramatically. And so what I've been doing until basically still, and I will be doing for as long as it takes, is meeting with them, trying to approach it like a lobbyist. A lot of these groups are great people, and they try for good things, but they don't understand how the process works. I, unfortunately, know how the process works. I was a killer in there. I didn't kill anybody, but I was a killer lobbyist. I only lost one time, and that was the one time that senator didn't stay where we thought we had him. In 10 years, I lost once. So unfortunately, in a very evil system, I know how to play in that system. So I decided to take that knowledge and the knowledge I have of what goes on and try to put it to some good and maybe and hopefully undo some of that system. And then at that point, I go home because I don't think there's a role for me beyond that. I have 5 children, 2 of whom are severely damaged, you know, from this process, and I need to attend to them. But that's what I'm doing at this point. And so anyway, when I had the honor to sit next to Katrina on this show, Chris Hayes' show, and found myself agreeing with her and with Chris on lots of stuff, I thought, wow, that's amazing.
Nation Conversations is a product of The Nation magazine and is available on iTunes. You can hear more podcasts at thenation.com/audio. Thanks for listening.